say goodbye to our friend Robert Chassel. I noticed some of you have come in and you didn't notice there were bulletins. There's some there and some there. You're going to need them to sing the words to the hymns. So maybe I'll give you a minute. If you didn't pick up a bulletin, there's some in the back and there's some out here. I know that some of you don't have them. Our first hymn this morning, we're going to be singing some hymns, is Morning Has Broken, 200, we don't care about the number, it's in your book. And this is just a celebration of the beauties of creation. Bob was very clear, he did not want a super religious ceremony, and we are doing our best. So Morning Has Broken. The first volume of his Utopian trilogy, And that, for some of you who don't know, can be found online at richardstallman.org. And we want everybody, so grateful to you for making that possible.
There's no Richard in the website.
Oh, it's just stallman.org. Okay. And also, if you forget that, you can find it. There's links to it from Fred's thing. And there are links from the obituary and all that, and from Wikipedia, I believe, too. So, my first reading, for those of you who have not read the trilogy, it's a science fiction trilogy. Probably not great literature, because there's a lot of monologue lecturing in it from one person to another. Knowing Bob, it actually had some pretty profound stuff in it. And these are all just from the first volume. The main character in this first volume is a man named Fildar, who was an engineer who invented something called the recorder, which actually could take any item in the world and duplicate it indefinitely, although the original item would be destroyed, but nobody could tell the difference on the duplications. It was essential for what comes later. So, and Fildar was an engineer, but he was also something of a Bob figure. And in one scene early on in that book, Fildar is sitting next to the deathbed of his beloved wife, and he is musing about life in general. And I quote, "Why are we here? What is our purpose? If you don't need a reason to live, then you just do. You just live. I bet the less aware animals are like that. But if you do think consciously, then you either have to invent a purpose yourself or put the job onto others. Mostly people put the job onto others, their culture or their religion. They are modest. Fildar knew people with ideas he would never think on his own, but he did not know anyone who could come up with a new, previously unthought purpose. He would have to pick an existing one. Ah, stewardship, he thought. That is the only purpose I can think of. My invention, the recorder, is new in only the most trivial sense. None of the ideas behind it are new. The device required hard work and intelligence, but it did not require genius. Fildar knew he was a steward. He was an intelligent steward. But the question he ought to ask instead was whether the culture in which he was a steward was good. What are the culture's beliefs? Where do they come from? And are they true? The value of beliefs is not in themselves. It is that by enacting them, you tell others you are willing to go along with the social customs. It is not whether you believe, but how you act that counts. And to be successful and in any way satisfying, a belief's practical embodiment must contain some truth. Fildar was not one to base his beliefs on love or fear or fascination. Consequently, he never considered those who believed because of those reasons. Often, such people were utterly convinced of what they thought, regardless of whether it was falsifiable or unfalsifiable or indeed utter nonsense. Shall we now sing him, "If I Had a Hammer"?
Hallelujah.
It takes place, Phil Gard is a professor of engineering at the local university, and he's in the faculty lounge, and a casual acquaintance of his comes up and is kind of frustrated because he's just come out of a frustrating classroom situation. Kilgard doesn't really know this guy very well or anything, but he's, you know, there. He's the first person that this man comes to, and he says, "Oh, they're, I can't stand these students. They're all ill-educated, and they do not think ahead, for heaven's sake." Kilgard replies gently, "Well, you know, you could be accused of being arrogant or politically incorrect," which of course immediately sets the other fellow back a bit. But I would like to ask the question of you, is that statement even helpful? And then he goes on. It is true that most people do not think very far ahead, but the reason may well have nothing to do with the education or with their native intelligence. That idea may lead you down the wrong path. Suppose the world is uncertain, which it was for thousands of years while we were hunting and gathering. For the most part, then, an individual or group should not look too far ahead. It is a waste of resources. Now, any anthropologist could tell them that, but a group needs some few who will plan ahead if they are to survive the next year. Even nowadays, a lot of groups do better than successfully plan ahead. And he proceeds for three or four more pages discussing that the truth or non-truth of evolutionary psychology, the history of language and of writing, the history and sociology, anthropology of hunting and gathering tribes, the arguments about nature and nurture, and maybe a little bit on the history of the Ice Age. And it goes on. Professor Tull was a bit startled, and his eyes may have glazed over for a smidgen. This is in Bob's writing. Philgard went on obliviously and continued and said, that is to say, it hurts most people to think far ahead. Also, presumably, that is why not most people are more optimistic than conditions warrant. But a few far-ahead thinkers enhance the chances of survival. Tull drifts off, and Philgard is irritated because he has stopped listening and thinks to himself, well, if he didn't want to explore the issue, why did he bring it up? On the other side, Professor Tull had been trying to make small talk, which he considered harmless. He had not expected scholarship. In his own mind, he likened Philgard's remarks to a harangue. He decided that Philgard was a stuffed shirt with an electronic speaker behind it, and he was best kept away from the faculty lounge, or at least someone to be avoided. And we thought Bob did not have self-knowledge. He had plenty of self-knowledge.
Distance is not.
technologically to, for the group of people who are trying to escape the Earth, to in fact escape the Earth, and then migrate to another planet some 100 plus light years away. And one of the most important ones of the technological breakthroughs was Filgard's recorder or duplicator, in which they could store the information for something duplicated in tiny, tiny little microchip type things and load them onto a relatively small starship, so to speak. And this way, the thing that took a long time was how do you get a living being to wake up when they have been sort of grown new from scratch, and then be able to, you know, sort of reproduce memory and all that. So, he goes into great detail as to how that is possible. Like all good science fiction, you believe it's all possible, given it's not fantasy, it's possible, given the science even we know today. All right. So they are getting ready to leave. Filgard, who never planned to leave with them, he was friends with all of these people who were going to go to the better Earth. He regards his friend Eltis, a woman, the founder of the Better Earth movement, and their chief logician, who is bringing all these scientific breakthroughs together. Filgard decided that Eltis was happy about the prospect of moving to the other planet, even though she would be unconscious for the next 200 years or so, but she wouldn't be aware she was unconscious for that long. But he, as a good engineer, considered all the steps they had to take before actually leaving, and he was not happy. He looked ahead and saw only hard work and possible defeat, although he believed enough in the cause to help them as much as possible. And he thought for a minute, after thinking that once his part was done, he would send him off and continue his life. But then he thought about it. He would like to colonize another planet. He would enjoy being reborn, too. He did not want to die. He was beginning to change his opinion. Maybe he could have a next life and still remember this one. The notion began to attract him. It was not a belief now without some evidence. People could go from one planetary surface to another without too much felt time in between, maybe none. Travel and terraforming would take centuries, but people would not experience that time. They would not actually live that time, and they would be reborn. But doubts came in. Would it really work? Filgard wondered.
Mm-hmm. grieve, remember, and say goodbye to my brother-in-law, Bob Trussell. I also need to add a disclaimer. Lois and I didn't coordinate what we were saying today. And she knows what I mean, and you will in a moment. Bob didn't care much for small talk. He thought deeply about ideas and loved to discuss them at length. While I have been able to abide a certain measure of small talk in my lifetime, I found that I really preferred the deep discussions that I cherished from the day that I started to get to know Bob while I was courting his sister Karen, until the day that aphasia took away his voice. That was almost as sad a day for me as June 30th was, when I learned that progressive supranuclear palsy had taken his life too soon. My bond with Bob began because we both loved his sister Karen, yet it didn't take long for me to form a strong friendship with Bob. We shared many common interests, from computer science to flying as private pilots, to discussing and enjoying technology in its many and varied forms, to discussing a wide variety of topics, most frequently bringing the discussion around to human behavior and how it could be influenced for the better. In everything that we did together and every idea we shared, one common thread endured. Bob and I shared a passion for optimism, and we believed that things would work out for good no matter how bleak they may have seemed. Bob carried this into the cockpit and was a master at keeping his cool when the flying became difficult. When the engine of his ultralight stopped, he landed at the local golf course, and we read about it in the Berkshire Eagle. When he and his mother, Margot, were flying across South Dakota during winter and the cold weather caused his engine to fail, he kept his cool, landed, and continued the trip and came to visit us with only a brief delay. He viewed his flight out to visit friends who were homesteading in Alaska with Margot as an exciting adventure. I got to experience his optimism several times in the cockpit, including one time when he challenged me to perform an extremely short field landing at an airport near Albany. And as I was able to successfully accomplish his challenge, he celebrated with me, and that was just such a wonderful shared experience. Bob loved history, especially the history of technology. While I didn't know Bob at the time, I have relished hearing the stories about the igloo that Bob built in the 1960s. That year, Stockbridge got enough of the right kind of snow that Bob and his friend Dale Reed could cut the properly sized snow blocks in the correct angle so they could build an authentic igloo that was large enough for Margo to bring the entire running crew again to. And despite the typical Berkshire winter temperatures that year, Bob slept in that igloo most of that winter. Bob also loved ideas that offered the hope of improving society. And I want to discuss four examples of these. He was captivated by the idea of logland and logman, engineered languages that were designed to be completely unambiguous, perfect for machine translation and artificial intelligence, to the point that he taught himself both logland and logman and got involved as an active member of the Logland Institute. On another occasion, Bob flew down to New York City specifically to purchase an electric typewriter with a Dvorak keyboard that he trained himself to use because it would overcome the intentional limitation of the QWERTY keyboard that most of us use. He also documented his ideas about economics and society in his lengthy essay, Choice and Constraint, containing his ideas about a world coalition government designed to promote a just and stable society. And you can find that along with his science fiction novels at Richard's website. There's also a fourth example that deserves broader explanation. I have been fascinated by computers since well before I quote unquote met my first ADEC PDP-8 in 1972 with a whopping 4K of core memory. As I got to know Bob, I found someone who shared my passion for learning what we could do with computers to make our lives better. Through Bob, I learned of the Free Software Foundation, the importance of open source software, and how software freedom could improve our lives. At the same time, Bob and I discussed and bemoaned Microsoft serving as a stark example of why software freedom was so important. We learned more about computers and software freedom together, and I dearly miss the days when we could compare notes on what we were doing and talk about strategies for making software freedom more relevant to the rest of the world. Bob died of a rare neurological disorder called progressive supranuclear palsy, usually abbreviated as PSP. This made Bob's death particularly cruel because Bob was careful to take very good care of his body. But this disease took away his ability to speak long before it took his life. For the past several years, the hearts of many of us have been breaking because we seem to have already lost the Bob we loved. However, I'm convinced that Bob would not have wanted us to bemoan his fate for long. Yes, we do need to grieve, and each of us in our own way. However, the grieving is made easier when our hearts break together. I believe Bob would have wanted us to remember and celebrate his life, extend his thoughts during our own deep discussions, especially these ideas that Bob cared about most. And I am sure that he would not have wanted us to engage in small talk.
I believe there is at least one remembrance we're going to have during this ceremony. You were going to announce how we were going to do that.
We are going to have other remembrances of Bob done in two different ways. First, we are going to open the floor for those who want to come and give formal remembrances. We also would like to ask people to save some of the perhaps not so formal remembrances, maybe some of the funny stories that we recall. And we're going to have a time during our fellowship hall, in the fellowship time in this hall just to my right after the service. And so it'll be up to you what you choose, if you choose to bring up remembrances. And just ask that we have some in both places. The first remembrance of Bob formally is going to be by Ed Northrup.
Thinking about our loss, and this Bobby, and it's also that whole wonderful time when his family was so inspirational to so many people, including my family. When we first came to Stockbridge in 1960, I was 12. This is probably a little adjustable.
Close to it.
Yeah. skis and skates, which I think she probably has every size now, and also started making syrup, maple syrup. Dad started trying to plant a garden like Margot. We didn't have really animals, you know, the way they had sheep and goats and all that. The garden was not weed-free. My dad considered himself to be a person with a black thumb, who I personally know that he killed an artichoke plant in California years ago. But, and he had a little pond there too, but it was always filled with some very strange insects. And he plant, has been known to plant asparagus upside down. But the industry and, you know, the optimism and the just the great qualities of the Chiselle family were such an important thing to my family. And that includes, you know, the arts. They were Karen and Margot with their brownie troupe and the weaving and teaching all of their friends to weave rugs on their looms. It really is extraordinary. I don't think I've ever met any other people like that, who are just so happy to share, asking for nothing in return. In the summer, it was the Chiselle's Pond that was the center of Stockbridge, and they invited all of everybody. I couldn't believe the people I would meet there, because I always sort of thought of it like mine, because that's what they would let you do. It could be yours. It could be yours, too. My father also, so Joe, they lived in Michigan before, and Joe had a music group. He played the, I guess it was an alto flute, it was a very big flute. And he brought all the music, all the, which had tons of parts. Like, if there's such a thing as a B-flat trumpet, as I sort of remember, he had music for that. And whatever you wanted, in whatever configuration, however many people, be it two or, you know, 10 people in your music group, he had the parts. And when I would come back from college, so I played in the music group too. And Joe and I generally played together. I had a tenor recorder, and it was just fun playing with Joe. It was just great. And after that, we finished the piece, I would generally take my toes, which were bare, and flip the music stand over. And he was totally tolerant of all of that nuttiness of a teenager, right? So, and my father continued that music group for many, many years after Joe was gone, and invited everybody who would like to come. And, you know, it was never about how well you could play. It was just the wonderfulness of playing together. And that is just totally an inspiration for Chiselle's. It's marvelous. I mean, he loved music too, all completely on his own, and sang, you know, for his whole life. But that was something extra special. Now thinking about, Bobby introduced me to Monument Mountain. And Monument Mountain, you know, has been a lifelong joy. Again, more lifelong joys. But it has that inspirational inscription on the rock near the top from Rosalie Butler, who gave the mountain to everybody. And it's something like, I give this, you know, property for the free enjoyment of the people of Berkshire for all time. And, you know, that doesn't just mean people who are born here, it means the people of Berkshire. I mean, it's everybody who comes here who can, is capable of enjoying the mountain. It's just right in mind. You know, their friends that the Chiselles had were just so various. And not only did they come swim the pond, but they lived in the buildings, and there were a lot of little buildings. And besides Bob sleeping out in the middle of winter, Joe and Margot also were in the lean-tos. You know, and the cow, I just have vivid, vivid memories of the cowbell ringing at the door, and the Bobby, you come in and say, how about a swim? And you just drop his computer stuff and rush off. Anyway, it was a marvelous, marvelous time. It's very interesting listening to your readings and about the science fiction and your stories too. And the idea of Bob thinking of himself as a steward. And the other thing I wanted to tell you about was our little writers group led by Dave Trumbull. I think you were there. him when we had our meeting by the pond at twilight, and we heard from Dave that you could write about anything. You could have a crazy premise, and all you had to do was really work it out in a realistic way, and you would have your audience. And, you know, Bob was a real good student, wasn't he? I mean, that's just exactly what he decided to do. And I do remember he did write a poem. It was about a glowing cloud at sunset, and I just remember the lambent gossamer. I don't remember the line particularly, but the words lambent gossamer, the discussion that ensued about whether lambent gossamer was a little too arcane for, you know, normal conversation, or whether everybody would really get that. Anyway, so he just was brilliant and selfless and completely practical, and he devoted himself to projects to, you know, for the good of humanity and the free exchange of ideas. And that's really what he cared about. He didn't care about, he didn't use his talents to work for a university or, you know, start a company and make $1 million, which he could clearly have done. Instead, he gave it all away. And he lived with his parents and his sisters, and, you know, he just tried to make the world a better place. What a great thing. What a rare, rare thing. So the house is gone. I regret that. But the light and the pond is owned by somebody else, but the land is still ours. Instead of making $1 million, selling it off, they gave it to the Nature Conservancy. And we went there on Memorial Day to fulfill my dad's last wish, which was to have his ashes scattered by the Valley Brook. Very special. When Margot died, my mother Margaret wanted to buy the place and start an artist colony, where the artists would all come for free. And, you know, she really tried to convince us, and we're like, so impractical. How would you pay for that? How would you pay for your old age if you didn't have that money and you spent it on that land? And who would run it? And all those crazy practical things. And we didn't do it, but I know she was right. Would you like me to? Oh, we'll do that later. Okay, great. Okay, fine. All right. I think we will move along. Why don't we sing him? Well, why don't we save those for later? Is that okay? We have a time. We're going to have a semi-formal time out during the reception when we can do the informal kind of remembrance. So let's sing Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Quick note, in some of the bulletins, this is a two-page hymn, and it's kind of quick, so make sure you find what page it
is.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I have the second page.
Yes, you do.
Open it. Oh, I see. All right, you have to sort of, yeah. Lift sort of folk wisdom of the time. I'm reading from the third chapter of Ecclesiastes. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love